Welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a little bit snarky about all things books. This is a new podcast, so if you like it, I'd really love your support. Please spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, and rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts. Let's get rolling. Hey, everyone. Before we get to today's guest, I wanted to tell y'all about something exciting happening at Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I've been wanting to start a Patreon community for a while now so I could bring you some fun additional content. And what's been holding me back is really time. I was barely keeping my head above water with handling all the elements of the podcast by myself, so there was no way that I could take on producing additional episodes. But after some sage advice from the one and only Annie Jones, which she shared in episode 28 of the podcast, I hired a professional podcast editor so I could free up some time to actually do some fun things that I'd been thinking about for a long time. So I'm thrilled to finally be able to offer y'all some bonus content and other goodies through the Sarah's Bookshelves Live Patreon community. So what is Patreon? Many of you all are probably familiar with this through other podcasts, and some of you are probably not familiar with it. But Patreon is a website where creators, and I'm using air quotes here, but you can't see me, and the creators being people that are artists, writers, musicians, podcasters, basically anybody creating some sort of content. Creators can offer exclusive bonus content to premium subscribers for a small monthly fee. And if you listen to lots of podcasts, as I said, you are probably familiar with this already. So here's how it will work. You will have two options to choose from. First of all, for $5 a month, you'll get five special goodies. The centerpiece of this content level will be the monthly superlatives episodes. I'll be asking each full-length episode guest to give me their picks for five bookish superlatives that are tailored to them, and you'll get all the superlatives for 1 month's worth of guests in one episode. Second, I will also be bringing you other special episodes throughout the year, and these will be on less of a regular schedule. For example, I'll be sharing some deleted content from big name guests, and the first episode of deleted content will be from the Annie Jones episode. And if y'all happen to miss that one, Annie Jones is the owner of The Bookshelf, an independent bookstore in Thomasville, Georgia, and she's also the co-host of the From the Front Porch podcast. She was one of my dream guests, and she was my podcast listener's number one most requested guest. I recorded with her for an hour and 45 minutes, and the episode that aired was about an hour. So I've got probably a good 20-some minutes of additional content for you. The other types of special episodes you'll get throughout the year are a year-end wrap-up type discussion, an analysis and commentary of the Goodreads Choice Award nominees. I always have very strong feelings about these when they come out, and you can bet that that episode will get pretty snarky. And I will have a co-host. It won't just be me. And I'll also be bringing you some other things throughout the year. That's just what you can expect in the first couple months. And also in these bonus episodes, you'll hear more from me. My regular episodes are pretty focused on the guest. Third reward for this $5 a month category is a 25% discount on my Rock Your Reading reading tracker. The 2020 version of this tracker will be coming out probably mid to late November, and I will send all of my patrons a discount code that they can use to purchase that if they want. Fourth, you'll get priority placement on the waiting list to be a guest on a mini episode of Sarah's Bookshelves Live. We've gotten lots of applications to be on the show, and I don't know that I'll be able to get through them all. So if you want to get yourself to the top of the list, this is one way to do it. And finally, you'll get access to the Sarah's Bookshelves Live patrons-only Facebook group. Sometimes podcasting can feel very one way, like I'm just talking to a wall. And two-way communication's hard. We can kind of do it on Instagram, but it's not the best for that. So the Facebook group will be a place where my patrons can interact with each other and with me You all can share book recommendations. You all can throw out recommendation requests. You can ask anything you want in this group, and hopefully somebody can answer it. I will be very active on it. This will also be a place where you can have input into the show. You can talk to me about guests you want to hear from. I might ask you to send me questions you would like me to ask a specific guest. I'll do some polls, and if I'm floating around an idea, I might ask you all for your thoughts about it in that Facebook group. So the second support level is basically just the Facebook group, and you can get that for $3 a month. You're probably all wondering, what will I be doing with the money that the Patreon community brings in? First and foremost, I'll be covering the cost of my podcast editor, who is really enabling me to do this at all. Let me just tell y'all, editing a podcast, at least this type of podcast where it's an interview style and there's a new guest on every week, it takes a really long time. It probably takes me 5 to 7 hours of editing per full-length episode, y'all. While I can get it done, I pretty much can't do anything else if I'm doing that myself. Plus, a professional editor is going to be much better at it than I am. That's the first place the money's going to go. And after doing a lot of research, I also discovered that good podcast editors are kind of expensive. The next place the money will go is to cover all the other costs associated with running a podcast. And these are things like hosting fees, equipment, programs, and apps that I use to produce the podcast, and some upfront costs like logo design, things like that. So how do you go about signing up to be a patron? I included a link in the show notes for this episode, and I also have a link in my Instagram profile. It's pretty self-explanatory once you click on the link. I think you shouldn't have any problems, but please feel free to message me on Instagram, email me at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com, or contact me on Twitter or Facebook if you have any questions or any trouble signing up. I also wanted to take this opportunity to thank you all from the bottom of my heart. I had no idea how the podcast would be received when I first started it. I never imagined in a million years that so many fantastic bookish people would end up listening and would end up actually coming on the show. I've loved getting to talk with some of y'all on Instagram, and I can't wait to get to know you better through the Patreon community and through the Facebook group. So thank you so very much. All right, let's get to our guest. And welcome to Sarah's Bookshelf Live. We have a full-length episode this week. And I love going behind the scenes of various corners of the bookish world, and I've always been so curious about how book editorial jobs at traditional media outlets work. So I'm thrilled that today, Christina Areola, the senior books editor at Bustle, is joining me. Bustle is a website focused on lifestyle coverage for millennial women, and Christina writes about literary fiction, nonfiction, young adult novels, romance, and whatever Reese Witherspoon posts about on Instagram, which right now is The Secrets We Kept by Laura Prescott, which is an awesome book. And she's also a recurring judge for Book of the Month. Welcome, Christina.
Hey, Sarah. Thanks so much for having me.
You have what is probably considered a dream job among many book people. And I would love for you to tell us a little bit about your background and how you sort of took the path to end up where you are now as senior books editor at Bustle.
Yeah, it's always such a strange question for me because I feel like there wasn't really a path to becoming a books editor. It wasn't a position that I really ever imagined existing. And so I kind of just took the normal journalism path. I went to journalism school at Northwestern. When I graduated, I took a job as an editorial assistant writing lifestyle coverage. And I always loved to read. That was, you know, a really big part of my life growing up. That was a really big part of my life in college. And so when I came into this role at, I was working at Latina Magazine, I decided that books were important to me and it was something that I wanted to write about. And so I convinced my bosses to, you know, let me do reviews and author interviews and roundups of books. And it was always just in addition to my normal workload. It wasn't my primary job. So one day I was on Twitter and I saw that Bustle was hiring a books editor. I remember at the time being really shocked that that was a job that existed and that I could apply for. And so I did. I applied for it and I heard back about a month later. And I think that one of the things that really set me apart from a lot of the candidates was that I did already have a little bit of experience writing about books because I had sort of carved out a space for myself in my current job to do that. And I was really passionate about diverse voices and about really opening it up beyond just literary fiction and using it as a space to talk about thrillers and to talk about romance and to talk about all these other types of books that people read beyond just literary fiction.
And I think that's something that sets Bustle apart. And especially for me, one of the things I like most about Bustle's book list, because I don't read strictly critically acclaimed literary fiction. I do love literary fiction, but that's not strictly what I read. And I love the diversity in y'all's lists.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Like, of course, I want to read literary fiction. I want to read narrative nonfiction. But I also want to read thrillers. I also want to read a romance. There's so many different things that I want to read at different points in my life. And because our audience is millennial women, and I am a millennial woman, my friends are millennial women, I try to think a lot about what they're reading and, you know, how that changes and what they're enjoying. It's really fun to sort of get to expand beyond just what the New York Times is covering.
And I want to go back to something you said earlier. You mentioned you have a journalism background. So you obviously were not an English major, correct?
No, I was not an English major.
Is that typical of a book's editorial staff at a traditional media outlet? Or is it the journalism path, the more typical path? Or do you have some people that come in from having an English major background?
It's kind of hard to say because it's hard to say anything about books media because it's so small. There is no books media at many women's publications.
Right, which is sad.
Which is very sad. I would say that it is not unusual for people to have journalism backgrounds as opposed to English backgrounds, just because we all love to read. And for me, I majored in journalism because I didn't really know what other option there was for people who love to write. I grew up in West Texas, hundreds of miles away from the center of publishing. I just had no conception of the idea that there were jobs in books. I knew, obviously, that there was an editor, but I didn't know that there were publicists. I didn't know that there were marketing people. I didn't understand how vast the industry is and how many jobs are actually available in there. And so for me, it seemed very obvious that if I wanted to write, then I would have to major in journalism. Creative writing or English just didn't really seem like something that would be sustainable or that could lead to a job. And so it wasn't really until after I moved to New York when I was 22 that I realized that those were things that were available to me. And so, yeah, I guess it just made sense for me to major in journalism because it bizarrely seemed like a more practical option than English.
Well, it got you to living a book life, so I think it probably was a smart decision. I was like you. I had no idea that book jobs existed of any sort. And I'm older. I'm early 40s. My life would have taken a very different path had I realized that right out of the gates.
I think my life also would have probably taken a different path. I think that I would have made more of an effort to get a publishing job right out of college and become, you know, maybe an editor of books. You know, I'm very happy with the way that my life and my career has turned out. But that is something I think about a lot. And I think about what voices and what people are we missing just because they don't realize that all of these opportunities are available to them. They're just all in New York City.
Which is tough because I lived in New York for, I don't know, 15 years. And it's not cheap to live there. So you have to have some sort of ability. And like entry-level publishing jobs, let's face it, don't pay a lot. So it's hard to make a life in New York City on those entry-level jobs. So I'm sure that it is scary for many people to take that path.
Yeah, it almost seems to be really unsustainable. I've lived here 6 years, and journalism jobs pay better than publishing jobs do, which is certainly a reason to stay in this line of work. But yeah, I mean, it is really just a situation that excludes a lot of really talented people. And I think that that's something that the publishing industry has been grappling with for a while and has been trying to amend in some ways. But I think it's just going to be something that they're really going to have to take a close look at for the next couple of decades.
I agree. So tell us, what sort of credentials would, let's say, you look for in hiring somebody for your editorial team?
I actually am the only one-person team at Bustle. I'm the only books editor. Like we've said, there isn't a lot of people who specifically focus on books in media in general. But I do have some things that I look for when I'm bringing on new freelancers or part-time staff writers. I mean, I want to see that you really are passionate about books. I know that sounds very obvious, but I think sometimes, especially with journalists, it's one more thing to write about, not that you are really, really in love with this book. we don't do reviews, and so I'm always looking for personal takes. What did this book mean to you? At what point in your life were you reading this, and how do you think that impacted how you felt about it? Because that's how I read. That's how my friends read. You don't read in a vacuum. You read this book when you were going through this terrible breakup, and it was exactly what you needed. Or you read this book after the death of your dog, and it was exactly what you needed. Or when you were changing jobs or whatever. You know, there's just a million things going on politically, socially, culturally, personally, that impact the way that you feel about those books. And when I'm talking to writers about things that they want to write for the site, I really want to see how they were personally impacted by the material that they want to write about. I mean, maybe that is partially because I don't have an English degree, so I didn't spend all of college analyzing the sentence structure of Jane Austen novels. I just read them and was thinking about how they impacted me in my life. And so, yeah, that's how I read. And that's how I think a lot of my friends read. And I think that's probably a lot of how our readers read. And I mean, I do understand that there is a very legitimate role of literary criticism. I just don't know that that's Bustle's particular purview. We're more about like a book club in website form.
You're giving book recommendations. And when I'm receiving a recommendation, I'm not going to enthusiastically run out to buy a book that has been pitched to me through literary criticism, if you will. I like hearing how someone personally felt about it, just like you're saying.
Yeah, and you want to know if this is the perfect thing to read in this situation, or if you loved this TV show, or 100 million different things, right? Like, I will watch a movie and think, I wish that I could read that movie as a book. And it's like, okay, well, here are 5 books that are going to give you that same experience. And so that's definitely more how I've always felt about the Bustle Books mission.
And I think that makes sense with just from my tiny little blog I have. My book reviews are the least read posts, and I don't write much of them anymore. It's more like my list with my quick takes that get the page views.
Yeah, definitely. Lists, essays, occasionally interviews. But yeah, there doesn't really seem to be a strong appetite for reviews.
So tell us a little bit about a typical day for you. What are your main job responsibilities? What does a typical day look like?
I mean, there is no typical day. A lot of my days start with email. I get a lot of publicist pitches. I get a lot of freelance pitches. And so I usually will spend like an hour sort of going through things, trying to keep it as close to zero as possible. Usually before this, I'll do a whole sweep of the news, what's happening in books, of course, but in politics and lifestyle and entertainment. Where are there opportunities for us to find a books angle on something? Because there isn't really a lot of books news generally happening, but there's news happening in every other section.
When you're doing your sweep of quote-unquote books news, do you follow various independent blogs or bookstagrammers? Do you consider that book news, or is that not in your purview?
That's not something that I would include in my sweeps, but that's something that is always being fed into my brain via Twitter and Instagram, seeing what they're talking about, the books that they're loving, the controversies that are going on there. Because sometimes there will be stories that emerge on Bookstagram and on Book Twitter that have stayed under the radar of media. And so, yeah, that's something that I definitely take into consideration. But generally, when I'm doing those sweeps in the morning, it's more just like, what is the big stuff happening? What is EW talking about? What is The Guardian talking about? The New York Times, Publishers Weekly, doing like the really big quick hits. And then I do have a post count. We have to do at least 3 stories a day. And so at any given time, there's a number of lists that are currently being written. And so I'm working with the writers to like curate those and to get those written. And then I always have a large number of freelance pieces that are in the works. And generally, our freelance pieces are more involved essays, they're reported pieces, and so they generally do involve a lot more edit work. So it's not unusual for a reported piece to go through 4 or 5 rounds of edits before it actually goes up. And so generally, I will spend many hours of the afternoon just working on edits. And then another not insignificant part of my job is keeping track of all of the galleys. I'm sure you do too. So many books. And if you don't open them for 1 or 2 days, it gets very out of control. So I spent maybe 3 hours yesterday opening books and logging books. And
how do you test the books? Do you sample the first chapter of each, or do you have any system for how you choose which arcs you're going to read? Because I assume you cannot read all of them. I mean,
yeah, I can't read all of them, but I do have 2 part-time staff writers who help me with reading. I tend to read the first chapter or the first 50 pages. And at that point, if it's something that I really think is going to be a bustle hit, I'll read more of it. I'll read all of it if we're going to do an interview or something more in depth. I mean, I would actually be very curious to hear how other people do this, because I feel like there is just not a good system unless you have a team of 20 people reading at all times. You know, it is sometimes a little bit of a shot in the dark trying to figure out, based on what bookstagrammers are saying, based on what my writers are saying, based on what freelancers are saying, based on what I'm seeing and hearing, and also depending on Kirkus and Publishers Weekly too, to sort of weed out some of the books that maybe are not being initially well reviewed, to try and decide what then I have to read.
Do you look at Goodreads at all for that?
I do occasionally. Goodreads reviews are kind of hit or miss for me, because I feel like early reviews are so often skewed because they seem to be author friends or people who are already excited about the author. Or it'll just be one star because I hate poetry. And it's like, why are you reading a poetry collection if you hate poetry? And so I generally will give them a skim and kind of see what people are excited about. But when it comes to scouting out reviews, I tend to focus on Kirkus and Publishers Weekly.
Yeah, I've heard many different systems of weeding through the ARCs. Me personally, I tend to read e-galleys. So I actually just request things I'm interested in. So I don't get that many unsolicited galleys in the mail, per se.
That's the hugest blessing.
Let's get into your book recommendations.
Awesome.
Christina is going to share two old books she loves, two new books she loves, one book she does not love, which I'm really excited to talk about this one, and one new release that she's excited about. Can you share your first old book you love?
Yeah, definitely. So I was thinking about this all week because, I mean, obviously there's hundreds of old books that I love. And I ended up settling on the one that I finished this morning, which is I Am, I Am, I Am by Maggie O'Farrell. Really, really stunning memoir and essays. It's about 17 near-death experiences, 16 of which were experienced by the author and one of which was experienced by her daughter. And it's just a really stunning, beautifully written memoir about life and family and adventure. And I was just completely blown away by it. I don't know how I missed it when it came out a couple of years ago, but I am absolutely obsessed with it now and I cannot wait to recommend it to everyone.
I loved that book, too. It was 5 stars for me. And I was very hesitant to read it because I thought the premise sounded sort of cheesy. I was like, certainly not one person has had 17 brushes with death.
Yeah, that was my initial thought, too. I was like, I feel like I could come up with maybe one. But all of hers were legitimately near-death experiences, which is sort of shocking.
And the way that she tied them in to sort of life wisdom, I think really tied everything together and made it not cheesy.
Yeah, her insight goes beyond what I have read before. I think that in the hands of a lesser writer, it would have been very cheesy, even having the same experiences. But she is so good. I've never read anything else by her before, and I'm really, really excited to dive into her backlist now.
I was going to ask you if you had read any of her fiction. So I did the same as you. I read this book first, and then I went back into her fiction. This Must Be the Place is the novel that I read. And you know what? I loved it maybe just as much. Her writing is still there in the fiction.
Wow. Yeah, definitely going to have to read that.
So that was I Am, I Am, I Am by Maggie O'Farrell. And tell us about the second old book you love. And this is actually an author.
Yeah, it's an author. So I'm obsessed with Megan Abbott. She's a crime writer and a thriller writer. And I think that she is so good. And she definitely has a very strong fan base, but I feel like she isn't as famous as she should be, considering how good she is. And I think that's going to change soon because she's got 4 books that are currently being made into TV shows. So You Will Know Me, Give Me Your Hand, Dare Me, and The Fever have all been optioned for TV and are in various stages of production.
I did not know that, and I'm so excited.
I know, and I feel like we're about to go through a Megan Abbott renaissance. It's going to be like the Gillian Flynn. Everyone is going to be completely obsessed with her. So I always, when people are looking for something new to read, I'm like, try Megan Abbott. Pick one, any of them. They're all so good. But my personal favorite is The Fever, which was inspired by the Salem Witch Trials. And it's about a group of high school girls who begin to have unexplainable seizures and they appear to be catching. So one girl gets them and then another girl gets them and a third girl gets them. And it sort of is like this family and friend driven domestic thriller with also this vaguely supernatural element that you can't really figure out if it's supernatural or not. And it's so good. It is like a read in a weekend book.
I think a lot of her books are like that. You can sit down and plow through them in like a day and a half, and they're great summer books. And I have to agree with you. The Fever was the first book by Megan Abbott that I read, and also I think still my favorite. But I love her in general.
She's eerie. Her books are a little, they're unsettling. I mean, they're not anywhere close to horror, but they kind of stick with you in a weird, visceral way. And I really, really like that. I think you just can't erase the feeling of a Megan Abbott book.
I think she writes demented high school girls better than anybody else I've ever read.
Oh, she writes high school girls better than anyone else I've ever read.
Yes. So that was Megan Abbott in general and The Fever specifically, but also the rest of her canon.
Yeah, just pick any of them.
And it's great beach books. Also, I would say when you're in a reading slump, she's a good pick.
Yeah, yeah. Her books are very propulsive. They're very easy to read. And I think that they're good fall books, too. Like, it is the kind of thing that I want to be cozy with.
Sure. Let's do your first new book you love.
Yeah, so two books from 2019, both by Latina authors, and it is Latinx History Month. So definitely a good time to read them. My first is Sabrina and Karina by Kali Fajardo and Steen. This is a lovely short story collection. It's 11 stories. They're all set in Colorado or the Southwest, and they're all about Chicanas. I'm from West Texas. I'm Latina, and these stories just felt like coming home to me. It really is so rare when you're Latina to see yourself and your family and your culture reflected in a way that feels true. And these stories just absolutely did it for me. I think Kali has a novel coming out, I believe, in 2021. And I think that she really is going to be an author to watch in the next couple of years.
I saw a little interview with her. I think it was on a Denver local news station. And she just talked about how she's wanted to write about her city seen through the eyes of Latinas. And she used the example that her neighborhood had been named the Highlands, but that's not what they ever call it. That's what the white population named her neighborhood.
Yeah. Some of her stories deal with gentrification and all these very real issues that are affecting Latinx people in Denver.
I really liked her personality in the video that I saw. I kind of want to read this, and I had not heard of it until you emailed it to me.
Yeah, you should definitely read it. I mean, it's really, really well written. It's a one world book. I can't recommend it highly enough. And Kali is just a really beautiful person. I love following her on Instagram because she's always shouting out her own personal favorite books and posting these beautiful scenes from the Wild West where she lives, just these beautiful landscapes of Colorado and Wyoming. And there really is a strong sense of place in her stories that I really, really love. You know, I just love that she stuck to that area. Denver, there's a couple in New Mexico. I think there's a few that kind of bleed into California. But it really is that West, arid and a little bit empty and wild. It's just, it feels so good to read those stories.
All right. That was Sabrina and Karina stories. And that is short stories, y'all, by Kali Fajardo and Steen. Let's do your second new book you love.
Yeah, so this is also by a Latina author. This one is a work in translation. It was written in Spanish. Optic Nerve by Maria Gainza. She is a Argentine author. This is her first book to be translated into English. It's so stunning. I don't even remember why I read this book. I hadn't heard anything about it. I hadn't read anything about it. I just got the book and it seemed really interesting. So I read it. And I couldn't stop reading until I finished. It's sort of similar to, I would say that if you enjoyed the Outline trilogy by Rachel Cusk, that this is something that you would probably enjoy. It doesn't really have a narrative. The narrator is an art historian. Maria Gainza is also an art writer. It's basically divided into sections, and each section is the story of a different famous artist. So El Greco, Rousseau, Courbet, and all of their stories are tied into something that's happening in the art historian's life. They're almost like these little vignettes, and they're about art, and they're about history, and they're about love and family and mental health. But really, I think the big takeaway of this book for me was that you don't have to have the right words to enjoy art. Which I think is something that I think about a lot when I go to an art museum and you see these amazing paintings or sculptures. And you're like, wow, I really love that. And here's how it makes me feel. But you don't know what the right words for it are. You know, like, I don't know what era this was drawn in. I don't know what kind of brush strokes these are. I don't know, like, kind of paints.
I don't have an art history background. And like we were talking about with the literary criticism, I'm not doing art criticism, if that's a thing. It's more like how it makes you feel.
Yeah, exactly. And so this book, both the writer and the narrator, and it is a little bit autofiction, are art historians. And so if she does know what she talks about, but she chooses to sort of talk about art in this way that is very personal, she does that through her own personal experiences and also through the experiences of the artists. It's funny because I read it and I loved it. And I kind of almost just read it in this vacuum because I hadn't heard anything about it. I hadn't read anything about it. And then the book just blew up. It got reviewed by the New York Times. There was like this huge profile of the author in Lit Hub. It is a good feeling when you just read something and you're like, this is really special. And then everyone else is like, yeah, this is really, really special.
And it's also kind of cool because it's rare, I think, nowadays for people like you and me that pay so much attention to the book world. It's rare to be able to read in a vacuum.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it was published by Catapult. So, you know, not one of the big five. It always feels really good when it's a small press. And I've just been recommending it to people all year long. I just think it's such a beautiful book. It's a hard book to describe, but just a really beautiful experience.
Now, are you yourself an art lover?
No, like I definitely wouldn't describe myself as an art lover.
So non-art lovers can love this book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
That is like the mission of the book is it's to sort of make it accessible to people who don't have a background in art history.
That was Optic Nerve by Maria Gainza. And both of your new books came out in April.
Yes, they did. Oh, weird. It's a good month for books.
April was a great month, actually, thinking back on it. I had a great month of new releases in April.
April and May, I thought, were just really outstanding. And I think September and October are also shaping up to be really, really good months, too.
Absolutely. I don't have a huge quantity of September and October books on my list of must reads, but every single one that I've read has been minimum four, actually a fair number of five stars. And we're going to talk about one of them shortly.
We are going to talk about one of them. Also, I don't know if you've started reading for January 2020 yet, but I've read about five January 2020 books, and all of them have been five stars. Don't make any plans for January 2020.
Well, some of the books you had emailed me that you decided not to share on the episode were already on my radar, and I have galleys of them, and I haven't read them yet. So that made me very excited to hear that you have read them and loved them.
Yeah. And I have two more right now on my list that I'm really excited about. I think it's going to be a weird year, but it's going to be a great year for books. So at least we'll have that.
Let's move on to the book you did not love.
I actually was thinking about this for a long time. And then the second that I remembered that this book existed, I was like, oh, it must be that book. I hated that book. The book is Eligible by Curtis Sittenfeld.
And here all the listeners explode.
I know, which is a tough one. Also, because some of my writers really did love it. And so it is still one that will appear in Bustle Roundups from time to time, because I think that my opinion is definitely in the minority. But I just hated this book. And I love Curtis Sittenfeld. Prep was a very fundamental text for me in high school. And I am a huge, huge, huge Jane Austen fan. I read Pride and Prejudice every year. And so I was very excited about this. But I just thought it was really mean-spirited. I don't think that she understood the spirit of Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy. I think she really, really misjudged who they are as people. And I thought that her versions of Liz and Darcy were mean. And I didn't think that they were in love. And I thought that they were both very ego-driven. And I know that ego and obviously Pride and Prejudice are, you know, major themes of the Austen work. But it just didn't hit for me in the Curtis Sittenfeld version. Yeah, I read it and I hated it. And I, you know, I sort of was just stewing in the fact that I hated it. And then shortly after it came out, it got a really, really scathing review in The Guardian. And the review was written by Ursula K. Le Guin. At one point in the review, she quotes Mr. Knightley from Emma, where he says it was badly done. And she basically just summed it up better than I ever could, why it just felt so angry and combative and just ugly and arrogant. It just didn't hit for me. And I know a lot of people really like that book, but I guess it's just me and Ursula. in our corner of non-eligible fans.
I have not read this one. I love Curtis Sittenfeld. I loved her short stories that came out, last year, I guess? And this is on my backlist TBR to read. So maybe I'll get to it at some point. And I'll see if I agree. Also, though, I have not read a lot of Jane Austen. I'm terrible about the classics, so I may not have that perspective going in.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely read, if you haven't read Pride and Prejudice recently.
I need to. My mother is on me every day about reading Pride and Prejudice.
I would read Pride and Prejudice and then read Eligible. I think with retellings, the thing that it's important is to capture the same feeling as the original book. Obviously, there needs to be plot differences or some character differences.
A creative spin, but keeping the spirit of the original.
The spirit, yeah. And I don't think that she did that. I think that she focused too much on the bad parts of Liz and Darcy's character, which are major plot drivers, but aren't the major themes of the book. Even if you don't read it, you should definitely read the Ursula K. Le Guin review, because it's one of my favorite bad reviews of all time.
I will. And y'all, I will link to that in the show notes as well. So that was Eligible by Curtis Sittenfeld. And let's talk about the new release that you loved and I loved too. So I'm excited to talk about this with you.
I love this book. The book is Wild Game by Adrienne Brodeur. And it's a memoir. The whole action of the memoir kicks off in the first chapter when her mother, who is this very magnetic, charming, larger-than-life figure named Malabar, wakes up her 14-year-old daughter, who's the author, in the middle of the night and tells her that she has just been kissed by their family friend, Ben. And so the reason this is an issue is that both her mother and Ben are married. And it sets off this decades-long affair in which the author is a co-conspirator, and it just becomes this wild family drama that spans for many, many decades. I keep saying that if you like Gossip Girl but wish it were set on Cape Cod, then you probably will like Wild Game, because it just is that level of rich people drama. It's a fun read because it's almost a bit voyeuristic. This is so wild. I can't believe people are acting like this. But Adrienne is also just a wonderful, insightful writer, and talking about her mother as this nuanced, complicated person, because I think it would be very easy to read this book and come away with a lot of really bad feelings about her mother and the way that she behaved. And Adrienne is so nuanced about all of the people in her life, including herself.
Well, because she really loved her mother throughout it all, even though she probably shouldn't have as much.
I mean, there were times when it was frustrating how much she loved her mother, because she was just behaving in a way that was really not compassionate to the feelings of her daughter. But I mean, it is just such a fun book. I think you can already get it if you're a Book of the Month subscriber. It was a September pick.
Yeah, I read an eGalley, but I also chose it as my Book of the Month pick because I wanted a copy for my shelves, and that just arrived. But I agree. I thought the story was obviously a crazy story, but what really made it 5 stars for me was her writing. She's a beautiful writer. And the Cape Cod setting. And y'all, if you like food, there's a big food element to this book, too.
Yeah, huge food element. I think everyone as an adult sort of goes through a period of time where they think about how their childhood has affected the way that they behave as adults. And there's so much of that in this book, so much introspection, and not in a way where it feels like it's bogging down the narrative or slowing things down. It feels very organic, and it kind of gets you thinking about your own family and your own behavior and how complicated so many of these situations that on face value just seem bad actually are.
Yep. And this actually comes out October 15th, everybody, in maybe a week and a half as of the airing of this episode. So if you're not a Book of the Month member, put October 15th on your calendar. And I'll say, too, I read it in a day and a half. It's one of those things you're going to fly through.
Finished it in a weekend. I'm not 100% certain on this. I think it's also being made into a movie or a TV show.
That would be an amazing movie. The setting.
Yeah, the setting of Cape Cod. It really does come alive. I've never been to Cape Cod. Obviously, I live in the Northeast, so I think I've been to similar places. But it felt like I was there the entire time. Just the way that they eat, the things that they do, you know, the way they go fishing and looking for clams and everything just really, really came alive.
That'd make a great movie. I'm excited to hear that. Okay, so that was Wild Game by Adrienne Brodeur, coming out October 15th. You ready to play Rate It?
I am.
So I like to end every episode with Rate It, which is a lightning round game where I throw out 5 bookish things, and they could be anything book related. and you rate each thing either 1 or 5 stars, but you cannot use 2, 3, or 4 stars. So almost like how you would rate a book.
Okay, so 1 or 5?
1 or 5, love, hate.
Okay.
Reading backlist.
Oh, 5.
But you don't get to do it that often, I heard earlier.
I don't get to do that often, but I love it when I do.
I agree, and I'm trying to figure out a way to work it more into my reading life.
Well, last year, actually, for the entire year almost, I had a system where I would read 1 backlist for every 4 forthcoming books I would read.
Oh, that's a good one.
And that worked out pretty well. I judged for Pen America in the fall, so I couldn't keep it up. But it was a good system.
I try to put them on library hold, so when it comes in, I'm almost forced to read it. So, number 2, Central Park as a reading spot.
5. I love reading in the park.
I do too. I miss it. What's your favorite spot within the park?
So I actually don't do that much reading in Central Park. If I do, I'll just find a lawn, perch out somewhere. But I love reading in Carl Schurz Park on the Upper East Side, which is this like beautiful little gem of a park. There's gardens and there's stone staircases, and it's really, really pretty. And it's right on the water, too.
That helps, for sure. Okay, number 3, books about 9/11.
Ooh, I'm going to go with 1. I haven't read any yet that I've really loved, but I'm not ruling it out.
Okay. How old were you when 9/11 happened?
I was in 5th grade, so I was like 10.
And you were obviously in Texas.
Yes.
Okay. I just feel like there's a plethora of 9/11 books coming out these days, fiction and nonfiction.
I think when you said that, I immediately thought of fiction, and I don't know that I've read that many fiction books that I really liked about it. But yeah, I mean, hopefully it'll be a 5 in a couple of months.
Yeah. I moved to New York 3 months after it happened. So I was not in the city when it happened, but the death pall of the city was very much still there when I moved there. And I have sitting on my nightstand right now, The Only Plane in the Sky, and it's nonfiction. And it's an oral history of 9/11, and I'm so excited to read it.
So I actually have read the article version of that.
Oh, you have? Okay, good.
Yeah, and it was fascinating. I would give that a 5.
I'm glad to hear that. I read the first little blurb, and it's from the perspective of somebody that was in the space station at the time, and he was the only person not on Earth when it happened, and he could see it from the space station. He could see the smoke.
Oh, my God.
So when I saw who it was starting out with, I was like, why are they starting out with someone from the space station? And then I started reading it, and I was like, this is brilliant.
Yeah, that is incredible detail. I didn't know that at all.
So I'm looking forward to actually diving into it soon. Number 4, attending the National Book Awards.
Oh, 5. It's so fun.
That sounds amazing. I saw on your Instagram that you got to go. I was like, oh, I have to ask her about this.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's so fun. I mean, I always work during the actual ceremony and for a bit after, but it's just so incredible, like being in the same room with all these literary luminaries. And then there's an after party. There's an after party. It's book prom. There are very few situations in books where that happens. And so I think when it does, you really have to have fun.
Did you get to actually speak with any of these legendary literary figures?
Not while I was at the awards. Some of the people who were nominated, I talked to before, after, but usually when they're there, I feel like they're just swarmed with people.
Sure. Number 5, compiling Bustle's best books of the year list. Do you love doing it or do you hate doing it?
Oh, man. I think I hate doing it. It's always very hard. So many good books come out every single year, and I almost wish that there were a better way to sort of do end-of-year coverage than best-of lists. One of the things that we've started doing is for every season, we'll also do an author roundup. So we'll ask a number of authors for whatever their favorite book is. So we just posted our fall one where we asked 20 authors what their favorite book of fall 2019 is. And I really enjoy that because I really think that who am I to tell you what all the best books of 2019 are? I mean, obviously, like, I guess I am the expert. At the end of the day, it comes down to, like, my decision and the decision of my part-time writers.
I think that's why there's so many lists out there, and that's fine, because everyone reflects a personal taste. And it's okay. These are your best books of the year.
Exactly. And that's sort of why I enjoy doing the author roundups, because you get it from all of these different people. I think it's really fun.
That's a cool idea. I like that. I'm going to go look up your recent one.
Yeah, it's a good one.
All right. Can you remind everyone where to find you online?
Yeah, definitely. So you can follow me on Twitter @C_Areola or on Instagram @TinaMariposa.
And she does share books that she loves on her Instagram.
I do. I do share a lot in my stories and on the feed if I can find the time to take a good picture. Yeah, and I love to talk about books, so definitely come find me.
Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was super fun.
I'm so glad that I got to talk Wild Game with somebody.
Oh my God, I cannot wait for everyone to read that book.
Me either. So next week, we've got another mini episode coming with our guest, Stephanie Freeman, and she is known as reads.on.wednesdays on Instagram. Talk to you next week.
Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at Sarah's Shelves, on Instagram at Sarah's Bookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com. Happy reading!